I am Plunt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In 2010, my guest now, Anjan Sundaram, was living in Kigali, the capital city of Rwanda, teaching journalism to a group of students. The experience is recounted in a new book, Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship. It's a remarkable book that looks at the lot of Rwandans who are under the thumb of a brutal dictatorship, yet, for those of us looking in, the guise is that of a stable democracy. Billions of dollars of Western aid is provided to the regime of Paul Kagame while it suppresses voices of dissent. Mr. Sundaram's students, as we find out, are exiled, imprisoned, or killed, while some go over to disseminate government propaganda. It's surreal, the fear that a lot of journalists go through, sanctioned by the state. The book provides the reader a sketch of Rwanda after the genocide, and I'll ask Mr. Sundaram for his view onto the future. The Kagame regime could be in power for the most part of the next two decades. Anjan Sundaram is an award-winning journalist who, while based in Africa, worked for the New York Times and Associated Press, as well as many other publications around the world. His previous book, Stringer, was on his experience covering the Democratic Republic of the Congo. AnjanSundaram.com is the website for more. The book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Dubai this morning, Anjan Sundaram. Mr. Sundaram, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess where you are, it's evening.
Yes, it is late evening.
Yeah, it's exactly 12 hours between where you are and where I am here in Vancouver. So we're in the same hour, I guess. How long did you live in Kigali?
I lived there just short of 5 years. So 4 years and 9 months.
What brought you there initially?
I was looking for a quiet place to write my first book in. My first book was called Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in the Congo. And Rwanda seemed like the perfect place. It was quiet, calm. It even seemed boring. And it was on the edge of Congo. So I could go in whenever I needed inspiration or needed to check some things or travel in the Congo again. And that's really why I went to Rwanda. I was offered a job to teach journalism to Rwandan journalists in a local program. And very quickly after I began teaching them, I realized that they were working in a very repressive environment, and that one of the first things they said to me was, how did your countries win their freedom? Your countries were not always free. Tell us how you won your freedom.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it must be fascinating to go into a country where the government is the way it is and have to teach journalism, yet at the same time, sort of the whole process of journalism is skewed by the government itself.
Yes, so when I went in, I had heard mostly good things about Rwanda. The press about Rwanda is largely positive, even now. And you read reports of reconciliation, about the peace, about how Rwanda's risen from the ashes since the genocide of 1994. And this is what I had read and what I largely believed to be true. And when I went into Rwanda, I realized this was far from the truth. And in fact, journalism was in very bad shape, and journalists were working in extremely constrained and repressed environments. People were unable to speak, and any criticism of the government was silenced, and this is why most of the news in the country and abroad is positive. A lot of the dark details about what the government was doing was being suppressed, and the journalists I was working with were working in local newspapers, some of which were forced to report the news almost entirely anonymously. And so you would see a very different kind of journalism in Rwanda. You would see these newspapers, which were very widely read. In fact, they were so widely read that as soon as a new issue came out, the issue would sell out, and vendors would start selling photocopies. The demand was so great. And these newspapers, there was one in particular called Umuseso, the early morning, would report these stories that were largely anonymous, no verifiable sources, and yet the stories were remarkably accurate. They would predict which officials would get fired, which officials would be accused of corruption, and so on and so forth. And the people of Rwanda would read these newspapers even though there weren't sources, because they knew that it was in these anonymous reports that were sourced from the regime itself. These newspapers had sources within Paul Kagame's government in Rwanda who were leaking information, and the people knew that it was in such gossip that they needed to look for clues to their future rather than in official statements or the theatrical parliamentary hearings.
So we'll talk about what it's like living in Rwanda and for Rwandans in just a sec, but the perception that of what life is like in Rwanda in the West is awfully different, as you've said, as to what's happening there. So is it then willful blindness on the part of a lot of people in the West as to how Rwanda is, say, covered, is viewed in our media?
It's a mix of willful blindness and also naivete and also ignorance. The first thing to know is that foreign journalists, foreign correspondents, are incredibly reliant on local journalists to do their job, and any foreign correspondent worth his or her salt will tell you that without strong local journalists who've lived through these stories and know these stories intimately, the foreign correspondent would not produce very much that is useful. In Rwanda, you have the situation where the local journalists are effectively silenced. They're censored or self-censored. And so the foreign journalist who comes in is getting a very biased and filtered version of events. And this means that a lot of foreign reporting ends up reflecting that biased view, which largely toes the Rwandan government's line. And that's one reason why foreign sort of journalism that is about Rwanda has been misguided or ill-informed. There are many, many foreign officials, diplomats, who are very aware of the repression in Rwanda, but simply don't speak up. And they don't speak up largely to protect their relationship with the Rwandan government. They fear that they will be thrown out of the country or relationships will deteriorate. And so that is more, that's a more dangerous silence in a certain way, because they know about the repression, and yet by not speaking up and not working to fix it, there's a certain dishonesty in that position.
And so
it's a mix of both.
Yeah. So there are billions of dollars that go into Rwanda in terms of foreign aid year in and year out. So are countries in the West that are providing this aid, are they complicit in all of this as well? I mean, is Canada, what's Canada's role in all of this?
Sure. Yeah. Canada, like many other countries, they actually benefit from the repression. Rwanda is one of the few countries where aid programs are carried out largely according to plan. Now, if you try to carry out an aid program in a place like India, for example, you'll have participation rates of 30%, 40%. In Rwanda, it's 95%, because when the government tells people what to do, people just come out and do it. They obey. If they don't obey, they are branded as traitors. They face consequences, they receive fewer services, they're harassed. And so you see these incredible participation rates that you would not see anywhere else in the world. And so it's in aid officials' interests and countries' interests, countries like Canada that provide aid to Rwanda, it's not in their interest to speak up about the repression because they benefit from it. So there's this perverse relationship between aid programs that are supposed to help the Rwandan people and the repression, which actively denies them their rights. Aid programs actually benefit from the oppressive environment that the Rwandan government has instilled and created in Rwanda.
So to your class of students of aspiring journalists, how many people were you teaching at any one point?
So about between 10 and 12 students. That's how big my class was.
Sure,
and none of them were practicing today.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues was shot dead on the day he criticized the president of Rwanda. Two girls went to prison for many years after insulting the president of Rwanda. Two others are in exile in Sweden. And the others have just joined the presidential propaganda team or simply abandoned journalism altogether because it's so dangerous.
So those people that join the regime, I guess they do that in self-interest or in I guess, protection for their lives or their families' lives. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's completely understandable, and you and I would make similar decisions in such a situation after seeing colleagues shot dead or imprisoned or forced to flee the country for fear of their lives. It's a very rational decision to join the presidential propaganda team and praise the president. That's the best way of protecting yourself.
Yeah. How old were your students?
Most of them were in their 30s, but some were much older, like in the 40s, late 40s even.
So when you start your class, and I guess throughout your class, I mean, I'm curious to know what interested them into going into the field of journalism. I mean, did you have discussions about that?
Oh, yeah, plenty of times. And I realized that this class of 12 students were among the bravest, most courageous journalists in the country. There were many others had already fled the country or had been imprisoned. And the people I was teaching were among the last journalists in the country. And so they were some of the most idealistic people who saw that their country was heading in a dangerous direction and had decided to speak up and stand up to the government. And these are journalists who mostly suffered for their decisions. So they believed in the power of the free press to bring to light some of the repression of the government and to improve the lives of Rwandans. They wanted to hold the Rwandan government accountable.
And in terms of the writing that you were seeing, I mean, you have examples in the book, but I mean, it was quite good, wasn't it?
It was mixed. There were some students who were excellent writers.
Uh-huh.
There were others who were excellent reporters and not such great writers. There were others who were more intellectual, but needed help reporting. So it was a mix, and this is what happens in a country where journalism and freedom has been suppressed. People don't really have the space that's necessary in order to practice their craft and learn and grow. And so a lot of the skills that I was teaching my journalist students were about basic journalism and how to practice their profession in a free environment. And my hope was that one day, when they obtained their freedom, they would be able to exercise their profession as it should be exercised. But it was very clear that at this moment, the repression was so great that they had to find workarounds and different ways of reporting that did not anger the regime or put them at risk.
You talk in the book about some of the harassment you experienced throughout the experience living in Rwanda. Did you ever fear for your life at all?
Yeah, a little bit. But the precedent for foreigners has been to be thrown out of the country.
Mm.
And so a part of me knew that I was better protected than my Rwandan students who were risking so much more. They were Rwandan. Their families were in Rwanda. They had seen colleagues be shot dead. So I wouldn't compare myself to what they experienced and the fear that they lived in on a daily basis and the choices that they made. And it was a real privilege and honor to work with people so courageous who were willing to work for the greater good at great personal risk.
And so at what point did you decide that you had to write about this and write bad news?
So one of my students, Gibson, I helped him get out of the country, and I began to write his story. I thought it would be a magazine piece. I thought it would be an anonymous magazine piece. I didn't want to get kicked out of the country. And the magazine piece, the notes for this magazine piece, ran to 30 pages. Hmm. And then I thought, this is not just a magazine piece, this is something bigger, it's a book. And that's when I began to explore the country in a more systematic way and begin to try to probe the darker side of this dictatorship and try to understand the country. That was the moment I realized that Gibson's story was actually representative of a much greater and more important state of affairs in the country that I had unique access to. And so I should write something about it.
And so how did you write it while in Rwanda?
Oh, it was extremely complicated. I took notes in code. I switched people's names just in case my notebooks were found. I didn't want people to get into trouble. I would send the notebooks out of the country. I kept a low profile. I did not publish anything about what I saw for many years, for 3 years. I just traveled, interviewed people, took notes, and wrote my book. And it was only when I had completed the research for my book that I broke my silence and decided to begin to speak up about some of the things that I was seeing. Because I knew that at that point, if I got thrown out, it would be okay, and the free press by then had already been destroyed. Until then, my concern had been for the lives and protection of my students, and I thought I should stay silent just so I could remain in the country and help them as best as I could. But once the free press was destroyed, then that incentive was gone, and I decided to start writing. It was extremely difficult to write this book in the country because every time I stepped out of my house and spoke to anyone about what I had seen, people would push back and criticize me. And it's a very disconcerting experience to have heard an explosion, a grenade explosion, for example, and then for everyone around you to tell you that it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And you begin to distrust yourself. You begin to distrust what you saw, what you heard, what you felt in your skin. And it's a very traumatizing experience. And that it was in that kind of state, an environment. It was in that kind of environment that this book was written.
Yeah, just what it does for one's mental state, whether it's yours or the people in the Rwandans themselves. I mean, that's something that in reading your book is absolutely frightening and fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, I think that was one of the key experiences that was one of the most important things that I wanted to communicate in this book. I wanted to give a sense for what it feels like to live in a dictatorship and what it feels like to no longer trust what you're seeing or hearing and no longer trust yourself and to constantly live in fear of betrayal from others and yourself. There's very little sense of security, very few things that one can trust. And it's a frightening way to live. And many, many Rwandans live this daily, and I experienced it a little bit. And so I was able to enter their world to some extent. But the little that I saw, I think, was absolutely terrifying. I can only imagine what it's like to live in this way on a daily basis. Even though from the outside everything looks calm and perfect and serene, it's in the mind, it's in the psychology of people that one needs to go to understand and explore the effects of dictatorship. It's a very subtle, almost invisible force.
So one assumes that because there's a dictatorship that the country is stable. But within the country, and even though Kagame could be in power until the 2030s, it is tenuous, is it?
So, like all dictatorships, so the first thing is, like all dictatorships, transition of power from Kagame will likely be accompanied by violence, just because there's no alternatives and he's destroyed every institution in the country. There's no parliament, no free press, no justice. It's all the power is concentrated in him. Rwanda's also never had a transition of power without violence. And so Kagame's repression only makes that prospect of violence more likely. And given the history of the genocide, this is, again, a terrifying thing, something many, many Rwandans would like to avoid. Like many dictatorships, while it's occurring, life looks pretty stable, and things seem pretty calm. But when the leader goes away, that's when chaos ensues. And it's been this way in Iraq, in Libya, in Egypt. After the dictatorship, there's a certain nostalgia even for dictators. People say, oh, it was nicer when the dictator was around. not realizing that it was during that time that the institutions in the country were destroyed, and that that is what led to the chaos now. And so Rwanda today is in a very dangerous place. It's a country without functioning institutions, a very tenuous grip on calm and stability, and were something to happen to Kagame, things would be extremely dire.
So where is the hope then for Rwanda and the Rwandan people?
One of the problems for the Rwandan people is that the world seems to look at them and say, "Oh, you experienced genocide. You experienced so much violence. As long as you have peace, that's enough for you." Not acknowledging that Rwandans, like other people, need functioning, stable institutions that will support their country and establish a longer-lasting peace. If the world were to recognize this and stop supporting autocrats like Paul Kagame and instead support the building of democratic institutions in the country, and the democracy can come over time. It doesn't need to be immediate 100%, but just to support that process, strengthening of civil society, strengthening of institutions, instead of the strengthening of a single person, that would automatically help ensure that Rwanda does not experience violence again, and decrease the likelihood of mass killings or ethnic violence, because under Kagame, ethnic tensions and the prospects of violence have certainly increased.
So what's fascinating about your life is that you could easily have gone into another field. I understand that you're educated in another field altogether, and you could make your living another way. As harrowing and surreal as the time in Rwanda was, did the experience at all validate the profession, the vocation of journalism for you?
It was a learning experience. My experience in Rwanda taught me the importance of a free press, taught me what can happen in a place when people are silenced, when journalism is not permitted. And it is terrifying. It is really terrifying what people will do to themselves when they cannot speak. And so I see each book, each experience as a learning experience, as an education in the world, and this is how I like to live my life. And when I was in Rwanda, I would wake up each morning and I would ask myself if I would have spent the previous day in another way. And the answer was often no. I was reading, writing, engaging with society around me, learning, and this is what inspires me and what excites me about life. And as harrowing as the experience in Rwanda was, it was very important to me and has taught me a lot. And like I said, it was a real privilege to work alongside some of these brave Rwandan journalists who risked so much and taught me so much.
This is such a powerful book and one that a lot of people will need to read. I very much appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Good night.
The book is called Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship. It's published by Random House. Its author, Anjan Sundaram, joined me on the line from Dubai in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.